The Guardian.
More people have died in the UK from COVID-19 than anywhere else in Europe. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly. On Tuesday, the Office for National Statistics published data which showed that the number of people who've died from COVID-19 in the UK is now more than 32,000, meaning it has overtaken Italy as the worst hit European country. As Keir Starmer put it at Prime Minister's Questions today,
"How on earth did it come to this?"
One government advisor we won't be hearing answering that question in the coming days is Professor Neil Ferguson, the epidemiologist whose modelling helped shape Britain's coronavirus lockdown strategy. Ferguson resigned on Tuesday after disregarding the government's distancing rules to meet with a lover. 6 weeks into lockdown, ministers and civil servants are turning their minds to what the Prime Minister, back in his place in the House of Commons, called unlockdown. He said he'll announce changes on Sunday, some of which could come into effect as soon as Monday. Johnson sounded more conciliatory and less defiant on Wednesday than in his back-to-work speech last week, in which he talked about the apparent success of the UK's approach. Is the government beginning to acknowledge some of its failings in handling the coronavirus crisis? And as Scotland pulls further away from the four-nation approach, my colleague Francis Perrodin looks at how the response to COVID-19 might impact future talks on the union. The Health Secretary Matt Hancock was able to announce the trial run of his prized NHS contact tracing app, asking users on the Isle of Wight to help him test it out. Hancock hit his 100,000 a day testing target last week, but only by counting almost 40,000 mail order kits that had been dispatched, but not necessarily carried out. The numbers then slipped back below 100,000 at the weekend, but that didn't stop the Prime Minister setting him a punchy new target of 200,000 a day by the end of this month. Is the government ready for the next phase of this crisis? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, it's lovely to be back in front of the mic chatting to you all as my brilliant colleague Jonathan Freedon takes a much-deserved week's break. But the show must go on, as it continues to do so in Westminster at least. So to help digest the news of the week, I rang The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. So, Kate, there was a bit of a different mood this week, wasn't there? So last week, Boris Johnson was back. There was the baby news. He struck this sort of quite upbeat tone when he came back and stood outside number 10 and said, oh, you know, other people will be kind of looking at our apparent success and all that. It seems a bit more somber this week with some of these really shocking data that we've had.
Yeah, the tone's completely changed because, you know, you can't get around those statistics. And it's been quite frustrating, really, to hear the government constantly say, oh, well, it's not really fair to make international comparisons. Yet, if we look at the information that the government provides us, the UK's line is soaring ahead of other European countries. And we are right now, in theory, we have the worst death rate in Europe.
And Kate, I thought there was a little bit more of a sort of conciliatory tone from Boris Johnson on some of these things at Prime Minister's Questions. So Keir Starmer pushed him quite hard and he didn't quite apologise, but he did admit there had been some mistakes, didn't he?
He did. And he said that he bitterly regretted the situation that's going on in care homes at the moment, which, to be honest, in political terms, is actually quite a big omission. And he also was really honest and said, you know, there will be questions to answer at a different time further down the line. And to me, that really alluded to the fact that he knows that an inquiry is coming of how they've handled all of this. So, yes, I think you're right, actually. He was a little bit more contritional in what he was saying.
And do you think that's an acknowledgement that the public now are starting to ask more questions? So the polling had been telling us, hadn't it, that the public was really supportive. And in fact, Labour had sort of played off that by being very cautious and kind of constructive. Do you think out there in the world, people are starting to worry a bit about how this has been handled?
There's definitely a sense that things feel like they aren't really moving forwards in a way that the public is fully behind yet. And I think particularly on this contact tracing app, there does seem to be some heavy scepticism around that. I mean, maybe we'll see that loads of people sign up to it. Members of the public are really happy to do it. But just a little bit that I've seen, there's this scepticism, which in turn to me shows perhaps there is this greater feeling of mistrust at the moment. Britain has spent many years now trying to go its own way and try to show its uniqueness. It's the extraordinary nature of Britain, that we are a special, special country. We've seen a lot of that rhetoric coming from the Conservative Party around Brexit. And none of this is chiming with the current situation that we're in now. For Britain to be behind other European countries in dealing with the health crisis doesn't feel like a natural place to be at all.
And that app, Kate, this is trying to make up for something that hasn't happened for some time, isn't it? Which is sort of tracing each case. And one of the other interesting admissions this week was some of the scientists saying, yes, actually, perhaps South Korea, which of course has tracked and traced every single case or tried to and has had far fewer deaths, you know, perhaps there's something we could learn there.
Yeah, we're hearing now that this track and trace solution, or using technology, using an app, that it's something that they would have liked to have done sooner. And in mid-March, the track and trace policy was dropped. And we heard from the health secretary, you know, that at the time they didn't really have the testing capacity to roll that out. And of course, in hindsight, wouldn't it have been great to have a huge diagnostics industry in the UK like other countries? But, you know, unfortunately, Britain didn't have that. So I feel like, you know, we were told at the time, oh, track and trace is not appropriate anymore, we don't need to do it. But now I think we're actually hearing that it was because we didn't have the testing capacity all along. And so now they're trying to spin it that this is going to be a really, really positive move forwards in at the end stage of this transmission rate, that basically we could have had it at the start, which is what South Korea had, but it's okay because we're now going to use it at the end. And I just found that really difficult to understand, just the benefits of that compared to having had it much earlier on.
Yeah, and I suspect the public will think the same thing. What did you make of Keir Starmer's approach at Prime Minister's Questions? Of course, he's had to make do with Dominic Raab, hasn't he? But first of all, when the Prime Minister was in hospital, and then, of course, last week, he'd been attending the birth of his son, Boris Johnson. So that we saw the two go head-to-head for the first time, didn't we?
I think Keir Starmer's quite an interesting opponent for Boris Johnson, really, because he is extremely courteous and he's extremely polite, and he does give ground when he thinks that it would be the right thing to do and it's what the public want to hear. So he's very, very supportive on the app, for example. And then I felt like he dealt these killer blows when it came to the statistics in care homes. And he managed to get that admission from Boris Johnson that he bitterly regretted the situation in care homes at the moment. We also had this confusing situation where Boris Johnson said that the numbers had actually gone down.
That's the number of deaths in care homes.
The number of deaths in care homes had gone down, and that doesn't tally with what we've seen. Basically, we say that Keir Starmer is forensic. That seems to be...
It's almost a cliche to say that now, isn't it?
And we definitely, as journalists, are criticised for perhaps using quite a lazy way to describe Keir Starmer. But, you know, having watched him at PMQs today against the actual Prime Minister, which is the first time he had to do... first chance he'd had to do that, I think forensic is the right word, and I think he's actually very effective.
Now, our attention late on yesterday switched from these terrible, terrible death figures, which obviously were our main story, but I don't know, like a sort of good old-fashioned scandal story yesterday, wasn't there, about Niall Ferguson, whose modelling has been quite important in governing the minister's approach to this crisis. He seems to have been not following his own rules.
Yeah, so we had this sensational story from the Daily Telegraph about Professor Niall Ferguson, eminent epidemiologist, someone that the government has taken lots of advice from, and particularly the person who pushed for a lockdown. And he actually breached those rules himself, basically breaking those social distancing rules that we are all supposed to be following. And I just think the hypocrisy absolutely stinks. You can't get around it. You can apologise as much as you like, but when you're asking the nation to do something like that, you have to abide by it yourself. And it also brings up other things. There are other people, Minister Robert Jenrick, for example, he travelled to go and see his parents and he breached the lockdown rules. So it would be quite nice to see the government give some stronger language around that, as they seem to have been quite prepared to do in the case of Niall Ferguson.
The Prime Minister said today, didn't he? So the government's due to review the lockdown on Thursday, but the Prime Minister said that he will announce on Sunday what the next phase will be. And some of those changes could come into effect as soon as Monday. Do you think that's going to make a big difference to people's lives?
I don't think we're going to see really big changes at all. I think if, you know, people have been forewarned not to get their hopes up on that. But you might see this change in terms of maybe being able to exercise twice a day. You might see some changes to shops, particular ones where outdoor space is possible. So the garden centres, the DIY stores, those kind of things, or places where you can go and do click and collect. But I don't think we're going to see any dramatic change at all for people. For example, the group that are shielding, people that aren't supposed to leave home at all, I don't think you're going to see any change. And at people with health conditions as well, they're going to be tiny tweaks, nothing major. And also, the government buys itself more time, doesn't it, by releasing some sense of where the nation is going on Sunday. A few little things come in on Monday, and then it might be able to say, but really, we're going to look again in another 2 weeks, which might be fine for some people, but some in the public might find that very frustrating, that they still have to wait even further down the line to hear more information on what's happening next.
And the government have been under massive pressure, haven't they, to lift some of these restrictions, but less so from the public and more so from some of their own backbenchers who feel it's a, you know, sort of terrible imposition, and also are really worried about the economic costs of it. And we heard this week, didn't we, that the Chancellor Rishi Sunak is trying to find ways of sort of extricating the government from the furlough scheme, this incredibly radical scheme where you've got millions of workers being paid by the government. You know, he wants to try and find a way out of that, but of course without creating an absolute wave of redundancies when he sort of pulls the plug.
It's a really, really fine balance. I would just say on the furlough scheme, there was a bit of briefing that went on about that, saying, you know, the British public have become addicted to it, or they're trying to wean people off it. I mean, people are only in this situation because the government imposed rules that meant it was impossible for people to go about their daily lives, go to work, earn an income and support themselves. So the public have only been doing what's been asked of them, and the furlough scheme was absolutely necessary. So I just found some of that language a bit offensive, really. I do understand that long term it's an impossible financial feat. It's too much money for the Treasury to have to give out to keep the economy going. So I do understand that pressure, but I actually, at the moment, I don't think that group of MPs who are absolutely clamouring for a lift of lockdown are actually going to win the day. They are a small group. They're pretty noisy. They're pretty vocal. And everyone wants the economy to get going again. Of course they do. But I still think the health side of things, the argument that's being pushed by Boris Johnson, Michael Gove and Matt Hancock, I think that's still the dominant force within the cabinet at the moment.
Kate, you were watching Matt Hancock, were you, in the House of Commons yesterday? He had a bit of a sort of ill-tempered clash, didn't he, with Rosanna Allen Khan, the Labour frontbencher. He's everywhere at the moment, isn't he?
This row with Rosanna Allen Khan, Shadow Health Minister, really ignited on Twitter. And he said to her, you know, her tone, she should watch her tone. It wasn't appropriate, which people found highly offensive. I watched that exchange and I thought Rosanna's questions were extremely hostile. That's her job. That's what she's there to do. She accused Matt Hancock of essentially cooking the figures on testing. And I think that was the thing that really riled him. But at the same time, Rosanna, as well as being a shadow minister, is also an A&E doctor, and she's been working on the front line. And so I think he entirely misjudged that one.
And now he's got another target, hasn't he? Boris Johnson said 200,000 tests a day.
I mean, I do at times have sympathy for him because, again, he seems to have to mop up around Boris Johnson. I think Boris Johnson needs to be very careful about those figures that he puts out there because they are difficult to meet. And you've seen one that was very, very hard to achieve already, which was the 100,000 tests. And we also have to just think, how effective is it? Surely the other strategies and other pieces of the jigsaw are more important at the moment. And that's what the Prime Minister should be focusing on.
Sometimes they kind of arguably distort what the government does, don't they? Because they pour all their attention into one particular thing. So it's fine if that's your priority. But, you know, there is this feeling, as you say, about care homes that because we all talked about protecting the NHS, shielding the NHS, that there was this whole other crisis erupting in care homes that we were sort of looking away from almost, or ministers were.
I don't think they mean to provide diversionary tactics all the time, but that is effectively what happens when Boris Johnson puts such a massive figure out there, particularly when it comes to testing.
That was The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. After the break, Frances Peridon analyses just how different the coronavirus response has been outside of Westminster, speaking to our reporters in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. We'll be back after this.
The Guardian Science Weekly podcast is exploring some of the crucial scientific questions surrounding COVID-19. from soap...
It does not matter how good your soap is, it is how you apply it on your hands.
...to social distancing.
The fact that we're doing this online means I'm unlikely to spread an infectious disease to you.
...to unlocking a lockdown.
If you ease off when your infections are still at a very high level, you're just going to maintain infections.
Listen to Science Weekly from The Guardian on Apple, Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, Westminster has been urging a strong four-nation approach when it comes to tackling the COVID-19 crisis, but the devolved governments of Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland have sometimes taken a different approach to Westminster, at least when it comes to explaining their thinking to the public. So how has the response differed outside of England, and what difference might it make for the Union going forward? My colleague Frances Perridan spoke to our colleagues around the UK and in Ireland to hear how things are going outside of the Westminster bubble. She has this report.
So as we start to lift the restrictions, the real risk, and it is a very real risk, is that COVID-19 runs rampant again. So a return to normal...
Up first, I'm heading to Scotland, where my colleague Libby Brooks has been covering how Nicola Sturgeon's government has handled the crisis so far. The last time Libby was on the podcast, she was reporting on the Alex Salmon trial.
I mean, it was a really peculiar situation to be in that, you know, what was set to be the biggest story in Scotland and looking to dominate the front pages for days, probably weeks, was suddenly superseded by, as you say, this much bigger story. And it was quite a disorienting shift in perspective, because I actually ended up having to self-isolate for the last few days of the trial myself, because my husband and my son developed really bad coughs. So yeah, it certainly was the case that the focus suddenly sort of moved elsewhere.
At the time of recording, Scotland has more than 12,000 confirmed cases and more than 1,500 people have died from the virus.
We know that Nicola Sturgeon attended her first COBRA meeting on March the 2nd, the day after that first confirmed case in Scotland, although her health secretary, Jean Freeman, had been representing the Scottish Government there previously. And the Scottish Government has been, you know, working on this four nations approach, but obviously with an independent health system, education system, legal system, a lot of decisions have to be taken in Scotland and be Scotland specific. Holyrood has put through its own emergency legislation that went through toward the end of March. Nicola Sturgeon has also set up her own scientific advisory group, again towards the end of March, which is the idea is that that's going to supplement the information that she gets from SAGE.
Sturgeon's consistently made announcements ahead of her counterparts, particularly, as you said, in London. And we saw this with her decision to close schools. Why do you think she's being more forward with messaging?
I think there are two things that we need to keep in mind about this notion of Sturgeon doing things differently or sort of being more forward. The first is a very prosaic reason that the Scottish Government press conferences are held at lunchtime. The UK government ones are in the afternoon. And so obviously, if you have an announcement that has been agreed for a particular day, she is announcing it first. I also think, though, that this has a lot to do with Nicola Sturgeon's unerring ability to speak human. Sturgeon's public tone has been really measured, very open, very humane. And I think the Scottish public are sort of really appreciating that. You know, the language around the exit strategy has been the same. Whilst the UK government was being criticised for not sharing its thinking, Nicola Sturgeon was saying, I want to treat the public like grown-ups. And perhaps that's one of the things that is being reflected in this notion that Scotland is doing things differently.
Scotland isn't the only country seemingly making its own way through the epidemic.
Then on the middle of that week, about the 12th of March, I remember that the First Minister, Mark Drakeford, was going to be doing a big opening of a national forest in Wales, a forest covering the whole of Wales. And I know he was very excited about this project, and he didn't turn up. We wondered why, and it turned out he was at a COBRA meeting. And at that point, I thought, oh, this is very, very serious.
Guardian correspondent Stephen Morris has been following what's happening in Wales. Again, at the time of recording, Wales has recorded upwards of 10,000 COVID-19 cases and more than 1,000 people have died from the virus.
Well, Wales has devolved and very proud of the powers that it does have. It is keen to exercise those powers in health and education. It's also much smaller than England and they can be a bit more fleet-footed. They also follow Scotland closely. They look at what Scotland's doing. And Scotland was moving that way as well, so Wales decided to do the same.
Steve, at the end of March, Mark Drakeford, the Welsh First Minister, called for more coronavirus spending in Wales. He said this was because of the country's older and, as he put it, sicker population. Did the UK government answer his calls?
I think the Welsh government would say no, and the UK government might say they've done their best and will continue to try and help. It's a long-running complaint from Wales, from the Welsh government, that it receives funds from Westminster based on its population, not on the needs of its population. And as you say, it always argues population of Wales is older, is poorer in many places, is sicker in many places, and needs more. And I think it needs more.
Personal protective equipment, or lack thereof, for frontline workers has been an issue across the whole of the UK, and Wales is no different. In the middle of April, the Welsh and Scottish governments responded to reports that the NHS in England was being prioritised for the supply of PPE over their countries. Downing Street denied this, but it was quite a moment of tension between the devolved nations, wasn't it?
It certainly was a very tense moment. The health minister in Wales, Vaughan Gething, definitely raised that at meetings with his counterparts. But certainly in Wales, as in across the UK, PPE is a huge issue still. They've dished out millions of items, tens of millions of items, but people are still talking about health staff, care home staff, are still talking about not having enough. So it is a huge issue still.
Please help us to protect you and to save lives. Together, we can do this.
One of the areas where devolved governments seem to be taking a different approach to Westminster is the contentious issue of how to exit the lockdown. Steve, at the beginning of last week, Mark Drakeford announced that he was ready to move the country out of lockdown earlier than the rest of the UK. But by the end of last week, he seemed to have changed his tune a bit by saying the four nations of the UK should come out of lockdown at the same time. Why such a change of heart?
Wales is desperate that all four nations of the UK do act together as much as possible. It's a proud country. It wants to do things its way. But it's also glad to be part of the union, at least the Welsh government is, the Labour-led Welsh government is. And so it believes, I think, that it was best to go into lockdown together and it's best to come out of lockdown together. I think there is a frustration from time to time that they feel that the UK government isn't involving them as much as it should in all the discussions behind the scenes. And perhaps last week he was trying to give them the hurry up.
Libby, like in Wales, at one point in April, Sturgeon mentioned the potential need for a Scottish exit plan, a specially tailored exit plan. She then published a framework for how lockdown would be lifted. The First Minister in Wales actually rolled back on this idea last week. But do you think the Scottish Government is likely to go ahead and break rank from Westminster on how they lift the restrictions?
There are concerns in Scotland that Nicola Sturgeon or the Scottish government has been operating too much in lockstep with the UK government. At the same time, though, she has always been very clear that if the science suggests it, then she will not hesitate to do things differently, particularly in terms of lifting lockdown restrictions. I think it was particularly telling last week when you had Boris Johnson talking in very optimistic terms about how we were past the peak. That message was really, really different to the message that Nicola Sturgeon gave the very next day at her press conference when she was talking far more cautiously, really urging Scots to stick with restrictions. She said that she felt that progress was still very fragile. I think we could be seeing some divergence, particularly this week, in terms of the way that lockdown restrictions are lifted.
The Northern Ireland Executive is working actively on our plan. At our meeting today, we have continued...
As we record, of the 1.8 million people living in Northern Ireland, nearly 4,000 cases have been confirmed, and more than 400 people have died from the virus. The Guardian's Henry MacDonald has a unique insight into how the country deals with crises.
Even in the darkest days of the Troubles, life did not completely shut down. In the first week of lockdown, as I walked around the same streets of the city centre in Belfast, there was complete shutdown. The shutters came down entirely. Nothing opened. And that's when it struck me, my God, this is even stranger and more bizarre than life during wartime.
Just like the rest of the UK, early on, there were differing opinions on how to handle the crisis.
The politicians initially were kind of debating whether they should go into complete lockdown right away, which is what the Irish Republic did, or follow Westminster's lead. There was some discord in the five-party coalition over that. That seems to have been ironed out. And pretty quickly, life was shut down, I mean, quite dramatically and radically.
The UK government has been struggling to defend its strategy of getting PPE to frontline workers and rolling out tests. How has Northern Ireland done in this area in comparison to other areas of the UK?
It's hard to make an overall comparison, but one of the pressure points for Northern Ireland in terms of PPE equipment has been the care homes. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence to suggest that there's been a lack of equipment for the care system for older people in particular and vulnerable people. So that's been a bit of a controversy, an ongoing one. The hospitals seem to be operating quite efficiently. The Nightingale wards that exist in places like Belfast City Hospital are very well protected. So overall, in terms of the NHS, it's not been as bad maybe as some other parts of the UK, but the real problem seems to have been in the care home system thus far.
So from 6 p.m. today, the following measures are being put in place, and they will stay in place until the 29th of March. Schools, colleges and childcare facilities will close from tomorrow. Where possible,
Northern Ireland can't just focus on what the rest of the UK is doing. It has had to pay attention to what's happening in the Republic of Ireland too.
Indoor mass gatherings of more than 100 people and outdoor mass gatherings of more than 500 people should be cancelled.
What jolted a lot of Irish people here to just how serious COVID-19 could be was when Google, which has its European headquarters here in Dublin, did a drill. They told all of their 8,000 staff to stay away from work. And this on the 3rd of March.
This is Rory Carroll, the Guardian's Ireland correspondent. More than 21,000 cases have been confirmed in the Republic, and more than 1,300 people have died.
And, you know, is this sense like, was this a vision of the future or is this a one-off? And, well, we now know the answer to that.
Rory, by the second week of March, Ireland and its neighbours were dealing with everything quite differently, right? The Irish seemed dumbfounded by the UK response.
Yes, because the Irish were started a lockdown process by around the 12th of March when the schools and colleges were ordered to be shut and other businesses were told or began to either shut voluntarily or were told to shut down. Meanwhile, Downing Street appeared to be flirting with herd immunity. And this completely alarmed and baffled Irish people that were kind of like, you know, why are they doing this? And do they know something that we don't? And so it's kind of a nerve-wracking time, a confusing time for Ireland, just when we were trying to get into our own mindset of, okay, we're heading towards a lockdown and seeing our neighbours doing something completely different.
It was maybe inevitable that people would compare the Irish and the UK responses to the crisis, but is it really that simple?
No, it's fiendishly complicated, and it's been quite striking to me to see a certain degree of kind of flag-waving, weird patriotism, making these comparisons that the Irish have got it right, and the Brits, or specifically the British government, have got it wrong and have screwed it up. This is on the basis that Ireland's death rates are significantly lower than the UK's, that our restrictions were imposed sooner and more consistently, all of which is true, but death rates, the difference could be explained because of population densities are different. Also, Ireland has a significantly younger population than the UK, which means the population at large here is less vulnerable to dying from the disease. And there are several other factors as well, which really muddies any attempt to make a direct comparison in death rates between the two jurisdictions. And so most experts, actually all experts that I've spoken to about these attempts to make a league of death comparisons, say it's just way too early to make any meaningful comparison, that we're months, if not even years away from being able to know, you know, how public policy affected death rates and to make a comparison between the two.
One of the big ironies in terms of comparing North and South is this. We heard a lot during the Brexit debate, both before and after the election, about people in the Irish political establishment warning about a hard border that Brexit might create. And the irony is COVID-19 has created a kind of a mini hard border. So, for example, crossing points from Derry in Northern Ireland into next door in Donegal, there have been checkpoints established by the Irish police on the southern side of the border, so to speak, and they've been checking to see if northern UK plate registration cars are trying to get into the Republic to get to their holiday homes. So there's been this kind of ironic, paradoxical sight of border checks, but not by the police in Northern Ireland, but the Garda in the Republic.
Henry, how's the First Minister Arlene Foster dealt with talks with Westminster and Dublin?
I think really, when you talk about Arlene Foster, I think you've also got to talk about her counterpart in Sinn Féin, the Deputy First Minister, Michelle O'Neill. I think it's worth pointing out the Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister wanted Northern Ireland to adopt the Irish Republic's much more stricter and quicker regime of lockdown. Arlene Foster resisted that and said she'd be led by the science of British scientific and medical advice that was being given to the central government in London. Interestingly, the person I think who's having a good, in quotation marks, war in this crisis is the Health Minister, Robin Swan.
Don't let anyone say this has all been overblown, because believe me, it hasn't. There is a risk.
From one of the smaller parties in the coalition, the Ulster Unionists, he took the health portfolio at the start of the year when devolution was restored here. Swan said, the only divisions I want to talk about are those whose lives we can save and those who lose their lives. And that kind of chimed with the general public. And I think both Arlene Foster and Michelle O'Neill have realised that the majority out there don't want party politics played here. They want the administration to work together in an officious way. They have to work together as a unit. And that is one of perhaps a benign byproduct of this crisis, is that the executive has to work harder. And I think the irony is that the longer the lockdown goes on and the longer this administration has to deal with the fallout from coronavirus, I think it prolongs the existence of the power-sharing coalition, which is always a fragile thing, can break down at any time. The pragmatic and the practical will prevail, I guess, over the ideological.
Tonight I want to explain to you why we have to extend current restrictions until the 18th of May.
Last Friday, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, announced that lockdown would be extended in the Republic of Ireland for another 2 weeks.
And also share with you our plan to reopen our economy and society in phases starting on that day.
But in doing so, he outlined a five-phase plan for how Ireland will exit lockdown.
And the UK, I think, has a sense of, well, is this, you know, a vision of Britain's own future? And I think it could well be, because, you know, there's so many similarities between the two jurisdictions. And so, of course, the British will have the advantage of being able to watch a little bit behind the Irish to see what their experiences are, especially in terms of watching the public's reaction and responses to this lifting, because analysts accept that the easing of the lockdowns will actually be politically far trickier than the original imposition of lockdown.
As we wait for the Prime Minister to announce the UK government's plans to ease us out of lockdown, there have been signs throughout this crisis that devolved governments simply aren't willing to wait to implement measures. But is this a quirk we can blame on a global pandemic? Or is this an example of a new normal that we keep hearing about?
The Scottish government has proved that it can work fairly effectively with the UK government. By the same token, I think it is clear that if Nicola Sturgeon decides, sort of as far as the science is concerned, that she wants to pull away in some way, that she is going to have the support of the Scottish public behind her. The tone that she uses, that I think is so different from UK government ministers, and I think is really appreciated. But having said that, you know, language and tone doesn't get you PPE and it doesn't pay your mortgage if you've been furloughed or get the sack. And so, you know, how the Scottish government deals with those sorts of ongoing economic issues as we sort of come out of this initial lockdown, I think remains to be seen too.
The effect of COVID-19 may be more profound on Wales than elsewhere because of what we've spoken about, the economic profile, the older population, more people in poverty, more people ill. So Wales might be affected more than certainly parts of England and maybe than the UK as a whole. So there's going to be pressures there. Welsh Labour very much wanting to still be part of the UK, very supportive of the union, as are the Tories in Wales. but others aren't. Plaid Cymru has been very vocal in its criticism throughout the COVID-19 crisis, both of the Welsh Government and the UK Government, and you do wonder whether this might help their cause for independence long term.
In terms of Northern Ireland, I think reliance on Westminster will continue and indeed will grow increasingly important for one reason and one reason only, financial support. But another paradox of this crisis is that the NHS has united people that for a long time have been mortal enemies. And you can see this on the walls of Belfast. So for example, in Republic in West Belfast, you have, I think, a place called the International Wall. Now, tourists flock to it. It's full of political paintings or murals. Slap bang in the middle of that International Wall, they've now painted this slogan in solidarity with the NHS and the NHS workers. Go across the river in the Loyalist East Belfast, young Loyalists have painted another mural, which is also singing the praises of the NHS and NHS workers. So the lionisation of the NHS, and rightly so, during this crisis has created a common bond, if you like, or a common touchstone for people that are normally, even in terms of culture wars, at each other's throats. And I think that's visually the most striking byproduct of this crisis in Northern Ireland.
Before we finish, I want to say thank you to all of you who've supported us. The Guardian's open journalism connects us and brings us together when we need it most. But today, our advertising revenue and newspaper sales are falling faster than ever before, which means we need your support more than ever. Your contributions will sustain us and make sure our open journalism stays open during this crisis and beyond. If you'd like to help, please visit gu.com/support podcasts. But for now, I want to thank our guests Kate Proctor, Frances Perridan, Libby Brooks, Stephen Morris, Henry MacDonald and Rory Carroll. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Please look after yourselves and thanks, as always, for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.